Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Gary Fuller. Gary is Senior Lecturer in Air Pollution Measurement at King's College London. He's also led the development of the London Air Quality Network, which is one of the biggest urban networks in Europe. He's also the author of a brilliant but somewhat scary book called The Invisible Killer, The Rising Global Threat of Air Pollution and How We Can Fight Back. Gary, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to read a quote from the book in a second, but just give us a sense as to why you wrote this book and why you wrote this book now.
Okay. You only have to open a newspaper and pretty hardly a day goes by without seeing some story about air pollution. I mean, in the last 6 months or so, we've learned that children in London are growing smaller lungs. We've had smogs in Delhi. We've had the UK government coming forward with a new clean air strategy. And I think it's really hard if you're outside the real, you know, niche expertise to be able to join all of these things together. And hence, that's why I wrote the book. So hopefully it will help people understand why we're here in this situation, how we got here, and how we can move forward. Yeah.
So I want to read a quote from the very first page of your introduction, which sets, I guess, some of the context and the scale of the issue. The quote starts, "More than 90% of the world's population is exposed to air pollution concentrations that exceed World Health Organization guidelines. Globally, 4.5 million people died prematurely from particle and ozone pollution in 2015. And then you ask these two questions, which is, so why don't we understand air pollution better, and how have we allowed it to build to the crisis we find today? So let's just start with that first question. Why don't we how well do we understand it? I mean, it's interesting, in the book you look at lots of different aspects and facets of, you know, what is usually called air pollution, and there are many, which you remind us of. But in terms of our understanding, just give us a sense as to how that's evolved, because the other point you make is, we've been worried about air pollution for at least since the medieval times, or certainly the 16th and 1600s and the 1700s.
That's right. If you go back to London in the 1600s, we had John Evelyn, who was a diarist at the time, actually observing what he saw around him, and he saw London that was full of smoke. And also he looked into the bills of mortality, which was the first kind of records of death in the city that were being put together, and found that people were dying of respiratory problems all around him. And this, he connected these two together, and really he was much criticised for it at the time. It was really going against the consensus, because if you think in a time before refrigeration, how would you store food, how would you store fish, things like that? You would smoke it, yeah? And people at this time believed smoke was a preservative. It was actually good for health.
Yeah.
So when plague and disease struck a city, people would often light fires to drive it away, because they associated illness with dampness, for instance. So he was really fighting against the consensus to say that air pollution was actually harming people. Even if you look in Victorian times, people starting to understand sulfur in our air that was rotting statues. You know, statues no longer had noses, gargoyles were less ugly. Because they were being rotted by the acidic sulfur. And people actually wrote, thank goodness for the smoke in the air to protect us from this sulfur. Unfortunately, it took a disaster, really, before we finally recognised air pollution to be the health problem that it is. And that was London in 1952.
Which was the smog, the great smog, and yeah.
That's right. I mean, a one-week smog killed, according to the records at the time, about 4,000 people. But that was reanalyzed just at the turn of the century, and we now reckon that was probably closer to about 12,000 people. And it took that disaster before we really recognized that air pollution was such a problem. And you can almost say the same thing keeps happening.
Yeah.
If you look, let's say, at Beijing, you know, over time, different cities have vied to be, let's say, the archetypal polluted city. So we've had London,
yeah.
We had Los Angeles, for instance, for quite a long time.
Okay. Yeah.
And then very much into this century, the mantle or the dubious title has probably passed to Beijing. And it took that really being exposed in the media, and China reaching a point where around 1 million of its inhabitants were dying early each year from air pollution, for them to recognise it and take action.
Yeah, because in early on in the book, I think you identified the where the worst 50 cities are in terms of pollution, and you say 24 of them are in India, 8 in China, 3 in Iran, 3 in Pakistan as well. So it's a kind of sense, I guess, at the global scale, do we see problems of air pollution? Are they predominantly, exclusively, you know, urban and cities in orientation? Has that always been the case? Or is that much more now because of the rates of urbanisation that we now see in places like China or in India?
I mean, urbanisation is a massive kind of social movement, really, isn't it? In the UK, around 80% of us live in what you might think of as cities, as big urban areas.
Yeah.
And globally, we've just passed the 50% mark, haven't we?
Yeah.
So no country really in the world has developed, I suppose, economically without creating and investing in cities. And it's exactly the same with the ancient civilizations. So cities are, you know, necessary for, I suppose, for humanity to thrive, but it's how we actually build them. The air pollution problems around the world, are they getting better? Are they getting worse? Certainly more people moving into cities is creating new problems. If you were to go to many places, let's say in India, you would have all of the world's problems more or less on your doorstep. So you could have modern problems to do with transport air pollution. You could have a bit of poorly regulated industry. And then you could have people living on the streets, burning rubbish and just cooking there on the streets to keep warm. And you could have that all within a couple hundred metres.
Yeah.
So the challenges they've got are vast.
Yeah, yeah. And just go back, because you started with what I really liked about the book, one of the things I really liked about the book was, you know, you told a sort of story about how the understanding of air pollution and the kind of the challenges around measuring it, has evolved through the, you know, so you start with John Evelyn, but then, you know, Robert Smith becomes, you know, important in the 1870s, and John Aitken. Just say a little bit about the sort of characters that you use in the book to help illustrate the, you know, how we understand better air pollution and how, particularly how we measure it, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that began to measure air pollution and take this study seriously in Victorian times. There's people like Robert Angus Smith, who went on to become really one of the founding people behind what we now have as our Environment Agency.
Yeah.
And did a lot of law in the UK. And he set out to measure air pollution because he was just given a challenge, really. The scientist John Dalton said to him, effectively, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between the air here in Manchester and the air on Helvellyn, which is one of the hills in the Lake District.
Yeah.
And he set out to make measurements everywhere. And quite a few people did the same. There's a lot of Victorian scientists, like John Aitken as well,
yeah,
that went out there with small pieces of kit, almost in the same way as Victorian plant collectors would have gone out to the Himalayas and somewhere and brought back a sample of air and seen what was in it. But we didn't really have any systematic view of air pollution, how it changed really from place to place and over time, until the turn of this century. And the UK leads the world in starting the very first air pollution measurement network. There's someone I discovered through the book, John Switzer Owens, who's, I think, become a bit of a personal hero,
yes,
really, from
you
reading
get
about
that sense,
it.
By the way, of reading the book.
Maybe this comes from my own
adoration that comes through in the pages.
Yeah, maybe this comes from my own sort of professional and scientific background as someone who measures air pollution. But in 1912, a meeting was held by just, I suppose, like any conference or exhibition that you might go to today. So it brought in what we think of as now as NGOs, so lots of smoke abatement societies, and stakeholders in terms of local authorities, as well as scientists. And they looked at the evidence that they were gathering on air pollution. There was lots of concern, but there was no real way to systematically understand it. So from this meeting, they resolved to create a national measurement network. And the world's very first national air pollution network didn't come from a government initiative. It didn't come from a top-down thing as we think of these things today.
Yeah.
It came from a group of people at a conference who simply resolved that something needed to be done. And amongst them was the engineer John Switzer Owens. And he was pretty unique in that he originally trained as a medical doctor, then became an engineer. And he just tirelessly brought all of this together from an engineering science background, tabulating numbers and even inventing some of the methods for measuring air pollution. And I'll tell you what, if you were to go out there, I reckon within 10 miles of here, you'll still find instruments based on his technology operating today.
That's amazing. And was he, the individual that also then used, was it the method of particles per square mile or something in order to give a more of a flavour to communicate it to the public? Was it him that did that? Yeah.
He also talked, he was much criticised because he tried to find ways of being able to express this sort of science and engineering in ways that people could understand. So not just members of the public, but people who were responsible for the problem. So politicians, and he did a lot of work with city councils and people from industry. So he wanted to express things in ways that people could understand. So he started expressing, it's odd actually, that one of the early ways of measuring air pollution wasn't to measure the amount of pollution in the air, but to measure how much fell on the ground. And you just think about it, there was UK cities through the 1920s were having in the region of 300, 400, 500 tons of soot and tar falling to the ground in every square mile. If you think of the challenges it must have posed for keeping a house clean, in addition, if you grew up with a coal fire, you know, that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah.
But he also invented the first methods to actually measure air pollution in air as well. And his instruments and things based on them are still in use today. And it was because of him that we finally discovered about the 52 pollution.
Yeah.
Because there'd been pollution episodes before.
Yeah.
London in 1948, the Meuse Valley in Belgium. There's a few cases in the US where there'd been really bad air pollution incidents. But because we didn't measure the air pollution there and at that time, we couldn't firmly connect them to the health effects.
Yeah.
But London 1952, thanks to Owen's instruments that were operating, there's about a dozen of them operating in the city at the time, and we were able to see as air pollution went up, then people ended up going to hospital, dying in their vast droves.
So people could see, I mean, in the kind of political and social context at the time, you know, it was observable in cities up and down the country and across the world that, you know, particularly those that had heavy industry, which many of them did, you know, lots of soot particles fall into the floor. You could see that, or at least medical records suggested that, you know, people had shorter lives or had more illnesses to do with, you know, respiratory issues in those cities at the time. But what was not a connection between those two issues because, you know, the idea of the soot was just not well understood in relation to its effect on health?
I think we came from this smoke as a preservative and the sort of miasma theory of disease that heat was necessary and therefore fire to drive away dampness and disease, which it is, you can imagine that context if you were living there in, you know, say through Victorian times. But there was no real firm evidence emerged until the 52 smog, when suddenly we have 4,000 people. It just really wasn't there, that connection. Amazingly, that connection wasn't made.
So what was it then about the 1952 incident in London that allowed us to kind of better connect, you know, what we could obviously see in terms of the smog and then the health impacts of it?
Well, first, it was the first time that we had contemporaneous measurements during an air pollution disaster, if you like. So although there was lots of evidence that, you know, people died during smogs, we thought it to do with the cold, for instance, that was normally there at the time. But this time we could measure air pollution and we could see it, and also the magnitude of just the number of people that died. It's interesting, in the inquiry from the 52 smog, with this new knowledge that smogs killed people, they were able to go back over time, relook at all the evidence they had, and trace back smogs all the way through back to the 1870s, where they'd found hundreds of people, or even a few thousand people, had died they just hadn't realised at the time.
Yeah, and you say in the book that as a result of that recognition, the inquiry that was set up after the after it by, I think it's Sir Hugh Beaver, to think of both in terms of what happened but then what needed to be done, was a significant step up in terms of a sort of political or policy response. Say a little bit about why that in itself became much more important as an inquiry, and then something must be done, you know, which we hear an awful lot, don't we?
There have been inquiries into air pollution and smogs and the conditions of our urban areas in the past, and largely government didn't react upon these. There was one through the early part of the 1900s, which really was headed by Newton and was just a massive, voluminous thing that nobody acted on. But Beaver came along. He was someone really different. He wasn't a politician. He was an industrialist and went on to be connected with Guinness, of course. And he's credited with starting the Guinness Book of World Records, or at least posing the question that started it. But that aside, he took a really pragmatic view of this and produced something that's really an admirably small report, where he laid out the problem and he laid out solutions. And the solution really was to tackle the smoke that just prevailed in London. It's interesting when you think about the 52 smog, lots of people now seem to connect to it. I connected to it through a family history, and that's told in the book. My dad was working in an undertaker's at the time. He had left school recently. And it's amazing, and it's put in the Department of Health inquiry, that people didn't realise that this smog was unfolding. It's only where dead people congregate and where the ill congregate that people realise something was happening. So rapidly, hospitals were overwhelmed, and then in their turn, mortuaries, because it started at the weekend, and then in their turn, undertakers. So my dad was a French polisher and an undertaker's, and he recounts the fact that it was a small undertaker's business. They were just completely overwhelmed. They actually had to start using their lorry that they used to collect wood to go to the hospital mortuaries to bring back bodies, since they just couldn't collect them fast enough. But to people in the streets, you know, everyday people living in London, stuck indoors with thick smog, you know, with visibility less than a few feet, you couldn't see the curb, you couldn't see your feet, people would have been mainly indoors. They wouldn't have realised that their neighbours were dying at a time without telephone. So one of the amazing things is that this greatest peacetime disaster in London kind of unfolded, and nobody realised it was happening until it was all over.
And was there something significant, Gary, that it was, we often hear, you know, because it happened in London, which, you know, was the biggest city at the time, but also is on the doorstep of Parliament, which, you know, we know makes a difference, and, you know, our sewage history is partly to do with that. I presume this was an issue that was affecting...
Government, it was affecting other things, but government in London government itself didn't really realise it. Going back to the episode of The Crown, which deals with it, if you've seen it, it's a very faithful recreation of many of the iconic photographs of the smog at the time. But the whole narrative that anyone in government understood what was happening, even less the Prime Minister and leader of the opposition at the time, was cognizant of the smog and the disaster, is just complete fiction. They, you know, it wasn't a few brave people in public health and in the Department of Health realised something was happening, and when it started going out, like knocking on doors where people had died, or starting to put them on maps that John Snow had done to see whether they could find, you know, infectious disease outbreak. Yeah. But that was it.
Yeah.
So The Crown, brilliant job, brilliant photography, brilliant recreation of this atmosphere, complete fiction apart from that.
Gives our politicians far
They've got the days of the week wrong. It happens at the weekend, but not
of,
in
know,
The Crown.
Being able to foresee it. But nevertheless, they did, and as you said, you know, the Beaver inquiry becomes what the Clean Air Act of 56, which is significant, but as you note in the book, slow progress. In a sense, the act is one thing, but actually making sure that the act is enforced and, you know, followed through is not straightforward over the, you know, the following decades.
Yeah, the rollout's really slow. Interestingly, this is some of the work I'm doing at the moment. The book got me much more interested in the historical parts, so I'm going back actually through some of the very early data I've managed to acquire an archive of the UK's air pollution records back to 1912, which has been in sort of in private hands for some time. We're going back and trying to mine this and understand it. And it's a bit difficult, but one of the things you can see is that London's air pollution responds and improves quite quickly, yeah? But other cities in the UK are much slower to take it up. So Belfast, for instance, by the time we were in the early 1960s, London isn't the most polluted city in the UK because it takes action early. Other cities are. So, for instance, Belfast is a lot more polluted than London at that time.
So that's partly a sort of, I guess, a sequential rollout where it happens somewhere first, but takes longer to be rolled out and enforced and enacted in different places.
That's right. But also the solution we come up with really gives us a lesson for today. The solution we come up with was to say that it was smoke that was causing the problem, and therefore we acted on smoke. What we didn't act on was the sulfur that was also emitted when we burnt coal. So we converted to smokeless fuels, still as much sulfur. The air pollution incident that happened in 1962, which was London's real last serious smog, so 10 years later, the sulfur dioxide in the air at the time was worse than it was in 1952. And by a solution of simply moving industry out of the city and building taller and taller chimneys led to the next problem down the line, which was the acid rain problems of the 1970s.
Yeah.
So, you know, scientists at the time in Norway were suddenly discovering that not only was the rain that was falling on them highly acidic, but the total amount of acid that was falling on their forests and fisheries was far more than they could ever produce.
Mm.
And no one really had considered that it was coming from somewhere else.
No.
So when they flew aircraft back across the North Sea, they could see quite transparently the air pollution from the UK and also from Germany as well and other places was just drifting over. So that set in train quite a program of reducing industrial air pollution. And that became the focus. We had to get the sulfur down, 30% targets were set, 50%, so on. But all of this time, if you look through the 1970s, people were pretty blind to air pollution from transport.
Yeah.
There's something I didn't use in the book, I don't think, which was a document written by the Royal College of Physicians, a venerable body, on air pollution. And they systematically, in the 1970s, dismissed really all of the concerns. They said the only hazard to do with diesel vehicles that they were concerned about was the volumes of smoke that were being emitted from the exhausts simply because they might cause road accidents and people wouldn't be able to see where they were going.
Yeah.
They didn't think of this as a hazard. So it took really into the late 1970s, connected a lot with the lead in petrol, for us to realise that transport was a problem. And now we've been battling transport since.
Yes.
So, I mean, here we are in central London. I think if we were to step outside and talk to someone walking past in the street and ask them about air pollution, I'd give it probably about 30 seconds before they would point to the traffic. Yeah? And in majority of people's minds, they always frame air pollution now in cities as being traffic.
Yeah.
But it isn't. There's a multitude of sources. You know, the air pollution that we breathe is affected by things such as agriculture in the areas around us and across, you know, northwestern Europe. And wood burning, another thing that's come about.
I want to come back to the transport stuff because I think that's really and fascinating. We can talk about some of the, you know, proposed solutions and ideas and some of the challenges around diesel and Volkswagen and, you know, all of these sorts of things. But just as a sort of second, just say something about wood. Is that a really? I mean, I can understand it being a problem in you know at the individual level or but in aggregate, is that a really big significant contributor to pollution in our cities? I mean, is there lots of wood burning going? I'm just staggered that is the case. Or that's just me being.
I think you're illustrating my point.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, quite. Absolutely.
You know, you're framing air pollution solely, or perhaps not solely, maybe that's unfair, but mainly through the lens of seeing it as a transport problem. And this is one of the reasons why we have persistent air pollution problems, because we just frame one aspect of the problem and try to tackle it. You can almost imagine it like one of those whack-a-mole games whereby you beat down one source and while you're doing that, some other one pops up just behind you. But yeah, wood burning's a serious problem. It's a serious problem right across Western Europe, and it's more the return to wood burning. So I don't know about your family history, but my mum and my nan, they were really pleased to see the back of having a coal fire at home. It was a daily chore.
Yeah.
And keeping a home clean when you've got, you know, an open coal fire is in itself quite a challenge.
Yes.
So they were really glad to see the back of that, to get gas fire and get central heating. But now people seem to have this different nostalgia and view for an open fire, and people have gone back. And let's face it, they are. They're lovely. It's wonderful to sit in front of an open fire with twinkling flames and to warm your toes, you know. And the hearth is at the heart of a home.
Yeah,
it is. I can see that. But if you look at the sophistication to which we go, even with badly performing diesels, which we'll come to later, hugely sophisticated ways of controlling air pollution. From your open fire, it just goes up the chimney.
Yeah.
From your more modern stove, and the better ones are much better than open fires, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
There are some means, but nowhere near what we do for industry and other sources.
No.
We've done some projects in the, well, government, if you look at the, where does it, sort of, there's an inventory of air pollution sources in the UK. And they say for particle pollution in the UK, just under 40% of it is now coming from solid fuel burning in domestic homes. And the vast, vast majority of that comes from wood.
Yeah.
Now, that's done theoretically based on surveys of who burns what. We've made measurements here in London, and we've also done some work looking at some of the other cities in the UK. And our first estimates were that somewhere between about 23 and 31% of the particle pollution that's created here in London is coming from wood burning.
Right.
7.5% of London homes burn wood, which doesn't sound that many. 4.5% of London homes burn wood. 69% of those are doing so in open fires. And the 1956 Clean Air Act and those that followed still apply. So if you go into a pub in London and you see an open fire roaring away, or your neighbours, they're almost certainly breaking the law.
Well, really? They are breaking the law. This is not, obviously it's not enforced.
And it's largely forgotten about.
It's fascinating. As I say, I completely accept your observation of, you know, the way I couch it or think about it. That was, I mean, one of many things in the book that I was just really surprised that was the significance of, you know, the return, I suppose, now, as you've said, it wood burning, but also in aggregate, you know,
it's quite a global problem.
Yeah.
You know, we throughout the developed world, you've got places like the Western Seaboard of the US, huge problems, Australia, and very, you know, especially in New Zealand as well. There's a lot of wood heating. It's a big problem.
Yeah.
In wintertime.
Right? Yeah. So I want you to say a little bit more, because I think there were several sort of themes, I suppose, that run through the book, at least, you know, from my point of view. And one of them, I think, was, you know, and you started to tell this story in a sense that the history of air pollution can be seen as a sort of history of incidents and crises to which we then respond. But in a sense, the response to that problem creates the, you know, the future problem.
Yeah, sows the seeds for the next one.
Mm. And then we move on to the next. And I just thought that was a kind of fascinating. I mean, what's your, is that just the way it is? I mean, in a sense, you know, I mean, should we, in hindsight, were we better placed to be making better decisions that, you know, when we were dealing with the smog, we should have taken home heating as being much more of a significant issue than we probably did. Was that just an oversight at the time, or, you know, was it easier to see in retrospect? Because the other one, you know, you talk about lead in gas, you know, in petrol, which was a solution to a problem as it presented itself with the knocking of engines at the time. In retrospect, you know, a terrible thing, and lead's caused. You know,
lead in petrol was also a way for someone to make a very large amount of money as well.
Of course,
they had lots of solutions.
Yes.
And some really quite good ones to the engine knock problem. but they chose one that they could patent.
Yeah.
And, you know, therefore sell a product that would make them quite a lot of money.
Yeah. But this sort of, you know, the progress of crisis response, you know, next crisis. I mean,
I think we still, it's sad that we still see it today. I mean, if you look at Beijing, well, if you look at China, China's air pollution has transformed this decade. It really has changed. You can look at, there's about 70 cities that are tracked by WHO, and air pollution or particle pollution in them has improved by 30% in a 5-year period. Mm. And it's a colossal change. It's very hard to find another time where change has been so rapid. So the Chinese have got it, but unfortunately it took a disaster for them to do so.
Yeah.
Now we have the same disasters unfolding themselves, but especially across India, for instance. So I think it's very sad. But why don't we look at air pollution holistically to solve it? And I find it harder to answer that one. In defence of the people in 1956, if you look at the photographs of London, certainly through the 1950s, it was savaged still by war, and we had things like rationing and so forth, and people had to make the decisions they had to do at the time. And of course, if we decided to look at the way people heat their homes, make that more efficient, look for alternative fuels as part of the solution, we might not have had the next problem.
Right. Yeah.
But there is maybe changes. The Clean Air Acts that were passed in the US, they were fairly broad, mostly focused on industry and transport, but yeah, they were fairly broad. And if you look at the UK government's new air quality strategy, that's trying to tackle every single source, from transport to agriculture to wood burning, and even starting to look at up-and-coming things such as the things we're using in our home, things like your printer, inks, the deodorant and personal care products you wear, and it's starting to flag those up as problems. So, admirably holistic. I don't know whether government is ever capable of being able to fight a problem on a broad front, so maybe it needs some sort of reductionist policy, well, reductionist approach, in order for policymakers to absorb it. I don't know. So we'll have to see whether the government's kind of new broad view of the problem does actually bring about any action. Or do inherently, I mean, you deal with policymakers all of the time, in terms of how future cities should be mapped out, how can we optimise them, how can we make them better places to live. And we're always taught, as people that study things, you have to pretty much present a reductionist solution. You have to be able to clearly have some messages about what they should do. So maybe we're always going to be stuck in this paradigm.
Unfortunately, I think you're, you know, I would agree in a sense, trying ultimately, despite maybe taking a very, you know, broad system-wide approach to understanding the nature of the issue, when you then get to what might be done, it very quickly turns to very, you know, specifics, very reductionist, you know. I wish it were otherwise, but I think I agree with you on that. In terms of, so if you, the book, you talk about, you know, some of those sorts of air pollution or pollution challenges, and you talk about smog, as was acid rain in the 70s, talk about ozone, which is obviously, you know, largely forgotten, although be, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, I think the point you made, leaded petrol and the changes, and you kind of address those sorts of things. And then, in a sense, you introduce a kind of new bunch of challenges. We've talked about, you know, wood burning and the return of that, agriculture persistent, but particularly because of increased use of fertilizers and ammonia runoffs and things like that. And then obviously diesel as a particular, you know, car-based or transport-based issue. But so I get you to say something about, you know, diesel particularly in a second. But when you step back, I suppose, Gary, you know, when you look at the kind of sweep where we've been over the last 100 years, progress has been made. You know, our places are less polluted or more or differently polluted. How would, I mean, you know, if you were given an aggregate position, which is unfair because, you know, I know, you know, it's all about the nuance of the detail, but made progress, you know, our cities are less polluted than they previously were, or is it, are they just differently polluted?
In the developed world, if we think about it, they're differently polluted.
Right.
We don't get pollution incidents and smogs that kill off thousands of people in London or hundreds in Glasgow or Manchester, yeah, as we had at those times. So that's definitely progress. But the impact of air pollution on our lives is just huge, and that's one of the other things that's changed. Perhaps as air pollution has improved for us, we're learning more and more, and I'll come back to some of the new sort of health evidence in a few minutes. Mm. But if you want to take a broader perspective and look globally, undoubtedly for people in the whole swathe of the world that you identified before, you know, the countries around India, Iran, China, across Malaysia and places like that, we've got what, best part of 40% of humanity lives there in the most polluted parts of the world, and for them the situation is almost certainly getting worse. Mm-hmm. Well, it's getting worse according to what WHO show over the last 10 odd years, with the exception of China, but their lot is not improving.
No.
Cities have a big role to do with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, we must, as we urbanise, we must find ways of being able to cram all these people together with the transport infrastructure that they need and the buildings and energy sources that are necessary to make cities,
yeah,
survive and thrive.
Yeah.
In some way that doesn't harm the people that are there.
And when you're looking at some of those less developed countries, or those countries that I suppose are in maybe in earlier stages of development, urbanisation, industrial development and so on, do you see the prominence and the significance given to air pollution being different than maybe it was in, you know, in the UK or in Western Europe? You know, if you go back, you know, 50 years or 100 years, are they more aware of, you know, the pollution and the issues and the need to tackle it, or are they really where I suppose we were, you know, in this country or in Europe, maybe, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, which was, yeah, you know, not significant as an issue. We've got other things that we need to focus on before we worry about that.
Yeah, I think they're in a different position to where we were, since there's lots of evidence. If you can look at some examples of some African countries where I've read their air pollution legislation, and in some respects, I think, for instance, that in Nigeria, it's actually better in some ways than ours,
right,
in its appreciation of the problems, appreciation of the indoor sources as well. But whether they have the rest of the governance structure to be able to tackle the problem, mm, and really it comes from trying to stop someone gaining advantage whilst disbenefiting their neighbours, really. You know, we used to think of smokestacks from industry as a sign of prosperity. Okay, the people living there had jobs, and it was great as an industrial thing. People were making money, and cities would thrive. And yes, they would, but at the same time, that is being done on the backs of all the people that live in the town or city that were paying the price for their health.
Yeah,
and having a system of government and civic society that actually ensures the industry and other people that pollute pay for their externalities,
yes,
is something we're just trying to develop. And if you look in the developing world, I think it's even harder,
yeah,
to achieve that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't do it very well here in terms of the, you know, polluter pays kind of principle and pricing appropriately externalities, particularly on the negative side. We're awful on, you know, in many respects on some of those sorts of things.
It's interesting that's actually being eroded further. If,
yeah,
you look at developments since I mean, the book was published, six months ago, mm, or something like that. If you look at what's happened in between, we're actually starting to see an erosion of the polluter pays principle. All through this, we've learned things like the precautionary principle as well, that, you know, we should not be experimenting on the population of our city. If there is something that we think is not only hazardous but risky, we should take precaution. We,
yep,
should be cautious before we roll it out. That's what we didn't do with lead in petrol,
yep,
for instance.
Yep.
And there's a lot of pressure within Europe at the moment coming from industry to balance this precautionary principle with an innovation principle. So you know, this precaution that we shouldn't be harming the public, or we shouldn't be forcing people to pay the costs of our externalities as industry, is stifling progress.
Yes.
And that narrative's being put forward.
Yes.
And that's one we need to fight back
indeed.
Against.
There are an awful lot of motivations that hide behind or sit within
yeah.
the notions of, you know, innovation and experimentation and
we
dynamism.
Undoubtedly, and you look at the climate crisis that faces us, you look at the air pollution crisis as well, and there's so many others, including things that are social and not environmental. We 100% need innovation. We need innovation to be able to take us from where we are now to where we want to be.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's just not all innovation is good.
No.
And so that's where the precautionary principle
yeah.
has to be in there to balance
yeah.
it. You know, we need things to take us forward to reduce our environmental impact and cure so many ills in society.
Yeah.
And that comes from innovation, but
yeah.
it has to be the right
yeah.
innovation.
Well, we'll turn in a second to some of the solutions or some of the ideas about dealing with the problems as we see them today. But just before you do that, you alluded to it a second ago. Just give us bring us up to speed on the evidence base now as it is in terms of air pollution and health.
Okay, so 1952
yeah.
taught us that short smogs were really deadly, and that's the way we tried to manage air pollution for some decades. In the 1990s, new types of health study came on board that actually tracked people over several years, you know, just over a decade. And they found that it wasn't really the spikes in air pollution, the smogs, that were responsible for ill health. People were dying earlier in more polluted places because of the air pollution that they breathe every day. So that's where we've stood for some decades. But now the emerging evidence is saying that air pollution goes further than that. It affects us through our life course. So, for instance, my colleagues, and I played a small role, but did a study of children in East London. And they went out for years measuring the lung function of primary school kids. And then when they mapped where the kids lived and where they went to school, they found that those that were living in the most polluted areas were growing smaller lungs. Now, to them, they probably won't notice, and unless they have ambitions to be like Mo Farah and become, you know, an Olympic athlete, the fact that their lungs are maybe 5% smaller than they should be will have no impact. But if you think about members of your family, your grandparents as or great-grandparents as they grew old at the end of their lives, old age is characterized by a battle for breath, the struggle to get up and down the stairs, the difficulty to shake flu when you get it. So there's a big concern, and we don't know if it is actually the case, but there's a big concern that we could be storing a health legacy that's going to be with us for decades to come. So when I say about life course health effects, that's what I'm saying. The exposures that we have perhaps before we're born as children are changing us that may have consequences later on when we reach, you know, these kids reach adulthood and when they reach the end of their lives.
Mm.
And that's where the emerging evidence is now.
And just so turning to some of the solutions, just kind of, so you make the point in the book that you think, particularly in a kind of urban context, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong at least, but my reading of it was, you know, the biggest single change we could make would be to reduce the reliance on the private car as the kind of main mode of travel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not, and that's actually reducing car usage, not just the type of cars that are in use, and we'll come back to that in a second. So is that that's right, in a sense that's the point that you're making, and
yeah,
moving
yeah.
people away from car to active modes of travel, cycling or walking, or using public transport, mass transit, where obviously pollution is spread across a greater number of people. Just say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I said earlier that we mustn't frame air pollution in terms of one source
yeah.
or one category.
Yeah.
But yeah, if we look at transport, if we can change the way in which we travel around our urban areas, we can tackle so many problems. So if we can get people doing active travel, it has many co-benefits. So if you look at the UK, 40% of the car journeys that are made in England, not just in cities,
yeah.
are less than 2 miles,
yeah.
and 60% of them are less than 5 miles.
Yeah.
And these things could easily be turned into walking or cycling for many of us, not for all, but for many. So if we can reduce this car dependency, well, yes, we can tackle air pollution. We can tackle the climate change emissions. We can tackle urban noise that we don't talk about very much that actually plagues so many people. And then we can get the co-benefits as well of the additional exercise. And you can see this in our health statistics, and health studies often point out bad things all the time, but there's been a study on a big, big group of people that's being followed in this project called UK Biobank, and there's about 400,000 or 500,000 of them. And they took the ones that were working, which was just over 200,000, and tracked them for 5 years, and when they went to the doctors, did they die, what they got in terms of illness. And even over that 500, even over that five-year period in this just over 200,000 people, you could see differences between those people that walked to work and those people that cycled to work. They were living longer, and those people that were walking to work had less heart disease, for instance. So it is there. You know, there's so much we can do if we could transform our cities. But it's also a big responsibility. We've talked here for, over 50 minutes. And pretty much all of it has been negative, and it's been about problems. And I think as scientists, we are very good at being able to diagnose problems, and we're less good at coming forward with solutions. And we're even weaker at coming forward with what solutions could look like to envisage a future. So, I mean, out here, if you look, I mean, here we are in central London, the streets are pretty much clogged with traffic. Some of that is buses, some of that is people in their cars. A vast amount of it is vans, yes. for instance.
Yep.
Transport for London did some work that said that I think it's 39% of vans are less than a quarter full, I beg your pardon. And so a lot of them are just plying around there largely empty.
Yeah.
So there's a lot we should do, not just involving active travel for us, yeah, and those that can,
yeah.
but we need to be thinking about other things, such
yeah.
as the deliveries and the logistics in our
yeah.
cities as well to
yeah.
make them work.
And just on that, because I thought this was really an interesting, which hadn't occurred to me, but the point you were making about cars, you're more skeptical about, say, the shift to electric vehicles or to autonomous cars, you know, in a sense, which in theory could make, you know, cars being used more efficiently, because you rightly or reminded me or pointed it out to me that quite a lot of a significant part of the pollution comes from wear and tear on the tires, which it hadn't really occurred to me on that. And if you have an electric vehicle, which actually in some respects could well be even heavier, wear and tear is greater. But could you say a little bit about that? Because I thought that was slightly counterintuitive for me, you know, in a sense of...
I suppose it comes back to this framing the air pollution problem.
Yeah.
You know, we frame air pollution in our modern time in terms of traffic.
Yeah.
You framed it in terms of cars.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's all types of
yeah.
traffic.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you go broad. I was stretching it to the delivery
yeah.
vehicles
yeah, right.
earlier. But we also frame it in just what comes from the exhaust pipe, and we get particles that are coming out from all of the other wear sources as well. So the tyres on your car, for instance, you'll have to change them maybe every 3-4 years, dependent on how much you drive.
Mm.
That tread is gone somewhere,
yep.
and a lot of it has gone into the air. We're also very worried about brakes. If you think of the car that you would have owned, let's say 20 odd years ago, maybe 30 years ago, it would have had drum brakes. Now everything has disc brakes, so braking systems are open, and the wear of pad on metal. Well, that goes into the air as well. And there's some pretty nasty metals used in that that really aren't very good from a toxicological perspective. Mm. And then there's the wear of the roads themselves. And all of this produces small particles that we breathe.
Yeah.
With the controls that are on modern vehicles, even now we think that the majority of particles that are coming directly from road transport are coming from the wear processes rather than from the exhaust. And for electric vehicles, there's been some fairly controversial studies that have pointed this out, and the electric vehicle, let's say, lobby or those people that think it's a solution get very upset about this. And it's difficult to frame it. If you like, it's electric vehicles at the moment are heavier than their conventional petrol or diesel equivalents. And theoretically, they should therefore be producing much more of these wear particles than, you know, the petrol and diesel driven equivalents. And when I say this, we get a lot of kickback. Me and colleagues get a lot of kickback from people that really think electric vehicles are the solution. Mm. So I don't say it as a barrier to electric vehicles. I just say it as something that needs to be put there as a word of warning, I think, for the electric vehicle industry. But they're trying to make vehicles lighter.
Yeah.
They will have solutions to this.
And what's your view on, because I think, you know, various cities, but certainly countries, are, you know, we're going to be diesel-free or petrol-free in terms of...
Well,
you know,
are we?
Tell me.
Look at the promises that have been made. I can list lots of cities, and including, you know, the UK government, Paris, Ireland. I was recently there. They're talking about being petrol and diesel-free. And I actually stood up in a meeting and said, what does that mean? How are you going to deliver vehicles, deliver stuff? We don't really have many solutions. It's okay maybe for the light vehicle end, for cars and so forth, but for the bigger things like lorries, for trucking goods over long distances, we don't really have solutions at the moment that aren't diesel or aren't rail.
Yeah.
And, you know, rail infrastructure is a bit of an issue.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to be... It sounds good, but I don't think we're going to be quite as petrol and especially diesel-free by 2030 or 2040 as we think we are.
Well, a healthy dose of scepticism and reality. I am all for that. On that note, I think you're also... which I found interesting in, you are... You're more sceptical about the kind of position, which is... Well, we don't need to worry about the pollution in because we'll just clean the air once it's polluted. And you're less convinced on that, in a sense, our ability to actually at scale, clean the air once it's polluted. You think there are inherent limitations on that?
Huge limitations. I mean, the concentrations of air pollution in the air that are affecting our health are tiny. We measure them in the parts per billion concentrations or the micrograms per cubic meter. It's really, really tiny amounts. And there's a lot of air out there. So in this building where we are at the moment, there isn't much air, and you could probably filter it and improve the exposure that we all have. But as for cleaning the outside air, there's a gentleman at the University of York that said it's like trying to air condition a room with the roof off. And there are solutions out there. People are being sold so many things to do with green walls, to do with... There's paint. There's a city in, and all sorts of coatings as well. There's a city in China where there's this massive smog town. It looks exactly like an industrial chimney, and it's meant to be cleaning up the air pollution for the whole city. But to be honest, if it was, then it would be sucking in passing children and things like this just to, you know, be able to clean up air from kilometres away. It's going to have massive, massive updraft.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't. It's just not realistic.
No.
It's like trying to take the milk out of your cup of tea or coffee. The answer is not to put it in there
in the first place. So in terms of... Just stay in this sort of technology sphere for a minute in terms of... solutions. Are there some that you are more favorably disposed to in terms of either pre or post pollution? I mean, Is technology the answer?
I think that the answer, and I know it's very appropriate to where we're sitting at the moment, but the answer really is about, for those of us in urban areas, it's about how we design our cities.
Right.
It's about, a lot of it's about transport.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's about the way in which we heat our homes. A lot of it is about the distribution of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And we need solutions to those problems. And they're not always going to be almost like technological sticking plasters on the exhaust pipe or something like that of the vehicles that go around. We need to fundamentally think about the way in which we're so dependent on these systems
yeah.
for our cities to work
yeah.
and how we can optimise them, not just for some sort of commercial expediency, but to actually make our cities livable and healthy places. So, for instance, I sit quite often with transport planners in rooms and presentations, and they tell me how many people arrive for what segment of time at the local tube station, at the bus station, where they're coming from, and things like this. But if you look around this room where we're sitting, the only two types of things that haven't arrived here on a diesel lorry are you and me
yeah.
and the water in this glass. Everything else has been delivered by a diesel vehicle, yeah? From tea, coffee, food, furniture, all of that. Mm. We really need to think about those things
as well.
That's
a good point. In terms of what should or could government be doing? And I suppose, get you reflect on both what national government can do and then, you know, what cities themselves do. Because obviously you are active in and, you know, in the London situation, and you know, London to varying degrees, you know, congestion charge, ultra low emission zones, you know, these sorts of things, which you know are absent in many of our other UK cities, never mind in you know places across the globe, which is a very kind of city government approach, because these are not you know national government issues. But just you know, what can national government be usefully doing beyond you know. Sort of lecturing people to, you know, to live better lives, as it were. But I mean, are there specifics that national government can be doing in terms of making this situation better than it currently is? Gary, what would be the top first things?
If we come back to transport, is to invest in our
right.
invest in our public transport
yeah.
infrastructure, and also to invest in the way in which we distribute goods.
Yeah.
Yeah. Undoubtedly. Invest in the ways in which we work and to make that more streamlined, perhaps reducing the amount that people travel.
Mm-hmm.
Think about planning, and my mother-in-law, for instance, lives in outside central cities up in the north of England, and the high street in her town is really suffering. So, you know, in order to go to like M&S, for instance, you have to be able to drive mm-hmm. to the out-of-town place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's huge social exclusion thing for her. She can't go out and buy a new Cardi anymore
yeah, yeah.
without getting a lift. But this is done deliberately. We're allowing these things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be restoring high streets. We
yeah.
need to be restoring communities. We need to be creating livable streets.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all things that only really government at both city and national level can incentivise. Look at the way in which we heat our homes, for instance. In the UK, it's only since we were, I don't know, it's all these troublesome new laws from the EU that have actually meant that we insulate our homes and that we have condensing boilers that we resisted for so many years that are so efficient. So by setting standards and by incentivising the uptakes of those types of mm-hmm. technology, then government has a huge role to play.
Yeah.
But it has to make sure, government has to create an environment where innovation and business can thrive in the right direction.
Yeah.
And such that these externalities, if you like, aren't picked up by the rest of society.
Yeah. Are you in favour of things like a carbon tax, or I mean, which is, you know, I mean, from an economist playbook, you know, my kind of classic response would be, you know, we need to...
Are you an economist?
We need to price carbon. I am. We need to price carbon, you know, and then you can deal with, you know, how you kind of alter the price to determine how much is produced, or at least the cost of doing it. But also, at the local scale, you know, it's inconceivable for me to think that within 10 years, every city in the country of a reasonable size, at least, will have some form of road pricing and or congestion charging, which I think is a good thing. because in a sense you're pricing a scarce resource, which is availability of space. And then we'll see some, I think we'll see some quite significant changes about how, you know, the road space is used versus public and private.
Can we solve these things by economics alone?
No.
Let's take,
Definitely not.
I know this is turning into perhaps maybe a too London-centric discussion, but let's take London's congestion charging zone. It was created in 2003, not for air pollution problems, but for congestion. Mm-hmm. And apart from the cash that goes to actually run the scheme, all of the rest of it then goes back into public transport. So about 6 months after congestion charging started, my parents that live in suburban London got two new bus routes. They live on a hill. They're both in their 80s, and they're in the book, so you can meet them there. But they live on a hill, and they got a bus route from the bottom of the road and from the top. And it goes to handy places, the hospital, the library, the shops that they need to go. And this for them means that they don't have to drive, or they don't have to get someone to give them a lift. So I think the economics, we can't see it as just taxing things. And also, we run a real risk of framing environmental measures that do good to a society solely in terms of tax. So at the moment, many cities like Manchester, and Birmingham are looking to introduce clean air zones or low emission zones. Yeah. And the debate there really is entirely on the taxation side, whereas it's not focusing on where the money goes. Or perhaps we should make a, why tax something? Why not ban it instead?
No, absolutely. I agree.
Take the condensing boilers. We railed against these for ages in the UK simply because indigenous, you know, manufacturers didn't like them that much. And then EU regulation come along and said, thou shall have condensing boilers. And everybody does, and we save a fortune on our gas. Now, whether we could have achieved that by taxation and incentive, I don't know.
No, that's a very good point.
It has a role to play, but regulation does too.
I wouldn't disagree with you at all.
That's why I'm not a politician.
No. I think you make a spot on point. I suppose part of my observation would be, I think we have definitely underused incentives through the tax system in order to kind of affect some of the behaviours that we would ideally want. So I agree with you entirely. It's not the be all and end all. I think it's an underutilised thing. So, I mean, we could carry on, but just to close, Gary, just give us a sense. It's all kind of difficult question, but, you know, given the progress that's been made, you chart some of it, notwithstanding, you know, it's different where you look across the world. Are you kind of optimistic that, you know, the challenges created by urbanisation and air pollution of those places, you know, are you optimistic that we'll grapple with them more successfully than maybe we have in the past? You know, when you look forwards,
I think there are reasons to be cheerful. Yeah. If you look at China, for instance, it gets air pollution now. It understands it and it sees the burden that it's having on its population, and it's taking action. The biggest and sort of civilization transforming program that's going to happen over the next couple of decades is China's Belt and Road.
Yeah.
So there's massive infrastructure going to be going along the old Silk Road and by sea into places like East Africa and so forth. Mm. And if China's awareness of air pollution burdens extends along this, and it's going to be a whole infrastructure thing. I think there's like 70 nations going to be touched by this project. Mm. Then they could do a lot of good. Mm. So there's a huge opportunity for China to do something that's really massively good for a lot of humanity.
Yeah.
If you look at the news recently, it's been dominated by things like Greta Thunberg's school strikes for climate, and that overlaps as well with air pollution, if you look at the demands that many people are echoing through that. And we've had Extinction Rebellion here in London, closing streets, and these are really mass movements of people. Mm. If you go to your car showroom, you'll find that people are leaving diesel cars unsold. They're just not selling in the volumes that they were. No. there's a huge movement for school streets as well. So people actually closing the roads around streets at the times that kids are going to school for road safety, for air pollution exposure, and just to encourage people to walk to school and kids to just play in the street. Mm. And these are really, really great movements. So these give me reasons to be cheerful. On the negative side, if you go and look into the US EPA, and I don't want to turn too political by singling out Trump, but the whole direction that's changing in the US to do with environmental policy, there are a number of real moving the goalposts that are going on there, such that the health evidence on air pollution and the imperative to action is being downgraded. Mm. And as I said before, in Europe, we're having real fight back, saying that this precautionary principle that's protected us from so many environmental hazards in terms of chemicals that we can't use, for instance, and that we don't use and industry has adapted away from them, should be balanced by this innovation principle. And as I said before, we need smart innovation. We can't stand where we are, but just because something's good, it doesn't mean that it's better. Mm. So whilst there are many reasons to be cheerful, and there's, I wouldn't say thanks to the book, but the book is definitely feeding into this greater interest in air pollution, then these are reasons to be cheerful. But behind the scenes, there are still the same sort of sinister forces at work, I think.
My guest today has been Gary Fuller. Gary, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for having me along.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.